The Sandstone Foundation presents Mormonism as a Cult, The Limits of Lexical Polemics, recorded live at the 1985 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 21st through the 24th. We take you to the Westin Hotel, Utah, in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
This is Mormonism as a Cult, The Limits of Lexical Polemics. Reading the paper today, we have Stephen D. Ricks, who's an assistant professor of Hebrew and Semitic languages at Brigham Young University, and also Daniel C. Peterson, who is an instructor of Arabic at UCLA, PhD candidate of Islamic Studies. And commenting on the paper will be Donald A. Eagle, the Arizona Regional Director, National Conference of Christians and Jews. So we'll just turn the time over to Ms. Dr. Ricks.
As missionaries in Switzerland, it's hopeless. We were frequently met at the door with, "Kommen Sie von einer Sekte?" which means roughly, "Are you from a sect or a Sekte?" Sekte, we soon learned, was the popular and even official label for our denomination, as well as for all others not recognized as Landeskirchen or state churches. The technical distinction between the two groups was simple. State churches could collect the church tax through a state tax office, somewhat like tithes being withheld by the IRS. But the difference in the popular mind made by this distinction was far weightier. Members of a sekte were effectively relegated to second-class citizenship in a land of state churches. Because of the word's negative connotations, to be affiliated with a sekte required a quality of courage, conviction, and indifference to the opinions of one's neighbors, which is hard for most Americans to imagine. Despite occasional protestations of the innocuousness of the term, the looks of horror which were elicited when we, in mock innocence, asked someone if he or she belonged to a sekte suggested that the word did have as strong and strongly negative emotional charge to it. Perhaps it was this use of the word sekte in the service of religious polemics which made us more keenly aware, since our missions, of a similar use of the term cult, particularly by evangelical Christians, to describe a large number of religious groups representing a very wide range of teaching and practice, from Ekankar to Mormons, from the Healthy, Happy, Holy organization to Christian Scientists. In at least two important ways, the terms cult and sekte are alike. Both words maintain an in-group, out-group division, and both pack a strong negative charge. On one side are mainline Protestant churches and, sometimes, but only sometimes, Catholics. On the other, groups like Jehovah's Witnesses, The Way International, The Church Universal and Triumphant, Jonestown, the Divine Light Mission, and the Mormons. There is no mistaking the implied guilt by association. After all, Jonestown was a cult, and look what it did. The powerful emotional impact of the four-letter word cult, carried even in its short, explosive, even violent sound, is illustrated by two recent letters to the Biblical Archaeology Review. The magazine is taken to task for having referred to the presumed site of Joshua's temple as a, quote, cultic center, unquote. One reader objects, quote, "Cult conjures up images of evil men deceiving people and leading them off into foolish error. When I read about the Mount Ebal altar, I don't want Jim Jones jumping out at me," unquote. Complains another, quote, "When you worship the true and living God, you are not engaged in a cultic ritual." Ironically, of course, these readers protest a use of the term which goes back to at least the 17th century, and which is precisely that of the Latin cultus. It is the polemical use of the word cult which finds no sanction in the Oxford English Dictionary. The term's impact is further illustrated in a classified advertisement routinely appearing in the respected evangelical publication Christianity Today. Mormonism is a cult, it proclaims. See why. Those curious to discover why will be sent the Utah Evangel, a publication which for sheer and consistent bigotry may be without peer in the anti-Mormon literature of the late 20th century. Would the impact of the advertisement be as great if it read, Mormonism is a religious denomination? See why. The term cult often appears with other words carrying a negative connotation. Recent publications like Walter Martin Confronts the Cults, Confronting the Cults, and Confronting Cults, Old and New, share with the French L'Offensive des Sectes, a rhetoric of conflict. The opening lines of L.D. Stryker's Cults, The Continuing Threat, recall Joe McCarthy. I quote, and I do not joke, the cults are coming to your city, to your neighborhood, to the family next door, to your family, to your life. An invasion is underway. Beachheads have already been established in communities throughout America. Unquote. Bob Larson imagines the war of the cults versus Christianity, while Walter Martin conjures up the shock troops of cultism. Also to be noted is the language of dehumanization and devaluation. A cult is a perversion, opens one book on the subject. We read of the chaos of the cults, the cult explosion, among other titles. Walter Martin grimly warns his readers that a, quote, virulent cultic revival is sweeping our country, unquote. Cultists are said to feed on nominal Christians. The Mormon Church is a wolf pack, according to Floyd McElveen. 1983 saw the publication of The Lure of the Cults by the sociologist and devoted cult watcher Ronald Enroth, as of H.L. Bassell's Unholy Devotion, Why Cults Lure Christians. Pronounced here is the language of seduction. Can we imagine the lure of the denominations? An interview with Enroth in Christianity Today bears the sinister and inflammatory title, The Dimensions of the Cult Conspiracy. Jim Jones, Sun Myung Moon, and the mysterious L. Ron Hubbard are involved, of course. But there is more. Quote, it is not unusual, reveals Enroth, for me to find students who are surprised to learn that the Mormons are a cult. Such naive folk are no doubt soon made to see the light. Mormonism is best understood, according to the book The Godmakers, in relation to the larger occult conspiracy of which it is a part. But if Mormons and others are to be classed as cults, the word must be defined. The term Sekte has, in Switzerland at least, a kernel of official meaning. However, in the absence of an established church in America, users of the term cult must provide their own definition for it. Some, following the sociologists, define a cult as a group which lives in tension with the larger community, demands a high level of commitment from its members, and tends to be authoritarian and exclusivistic. This, as a matter of interest, is a description that comes from, among others, an article that was written by Rodney Stark, who spoke this morning, and his colleague William Bainbridge. But if, by this definition, Mormon is a cult, other groups too may be so classified. Early Quakerism is a good example, as are the Amish. Atwood and Flowers, in their recent study of early Christianity as a cult movement, demonstrate that the primitive church itself reflected the same ostensibly cultic characteristics. First, early Christians lived in varying degrees of tension with both the values of Jewish society and of the wider Roman society. Origen of Alexandria exhorted 3rd century Christians to, quote, despise the life which is eagerly sought after by the multitude and to be earnest in living the life which resembles that of God, unquote. And the costs of discipleship in early Christianity were potentially high. The prospect of rejection, persecution, and even martyrdom were real, but did not seem too great a price to pay. Often, indeed, to suffer for Christ was viewed as a privilege. The whole epistle of Ignatius of Antioch to the Romans is a plea that they not pray that he escape the death of a martyr, but that he endure it nobly. If he can die in Christ, writes Ignatius, he has no desire to live. Quote, although I write to you while yet alive, yet I desire to die. My love, that is Christ, has been crucified, and there is no fire in me which wishes to be fed. Unquote. Further, as Graham Shaw has forcefully argued, there is an emerging strain of authoritarianism already present in the New Testament, and particularly in the Pauline writings. And, as for exclusivism, to the early believer there was no salvation outside of the Christian community, as is indicated by the saying ascribed to Jesus, "He that believeth and is baptized shall be saved, but he that believeth not shall be damned." Walter Martin adds to these cult characteristics the lack of professional clergymen, but here too he merely describes early Christianity. For Latter-day Saints, at least, who view their church as a restoration of ancient patterns, any classification which places them with the primitive church cannot be considered a slight. More often than by the sociological definition, however, cults are identified by their conformity to or deviation from a presumed standard of Christian orthodoxy. It is typical of cults, writes Walter Martin, that they, quote, blind their followers to the truth, unquote, and alienate them from a saving relationship with Jesus Christ. Earl Shipper defines a cult as a group which reinterprets or denies the divinity of Christ, offers an unbiblical basis for salvation, and claims a new revelation from God, which either restores a lost biblical gospel or teaches truths in addition to the Bible. This definition seems crafted to describe Islam, yet he passes by the Muslims to attack only such groups as Mormons, Jehovah's Witnesses, Christian Science, the Unification Church, and the Way International. His title, Cults of North America, betrays the weakness of his definition. If mainstream Christianity is applied as the standard, all religions which deviate from or reject that standard have to be classed as cults, including, besides Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, and Judaism. Recognizing that so inclusive a definition renders it almost meaningless, many, including Shipper, arbitrarily apply the term cult only to groups active in the United States. But even here, the net is cast wide. Walter Martin puts the number of cultists at 30 million in the United States alone. The hesitancy of our heresiographers to label major world faiths cults probably does not stem from principle. Gordon Lewis, it is true, defines a cult as any religious movement which claims the backing of Christ or the Bible, but distorts the central message of Christianity. But this could apply to Judaism. Further, the most recent edition of Walter Martin's popular work, The Kingdom of the Cults, includes Islam, and although unwilling to call it a cult, treats it in much the same fashion as other entries. Also considered is something called Eastern Religions, which seems to mean something like Hinduism. And after labeling spiritualism the most ancient, Martin tells us that the second oldest of all cult systems considered in this book is Zen Buddhism. Nichiren Shoshu, a Buddhist movement dating from the 13th century, is condemned by Martin among the new cults, a title which clearly betrays his parochial North American orientation. Such groups are included despite Martin's own declaration that a cult is a, quote, group of people gathered about a specific person or person's misinterpretation of the Bible, unquote, and despite his statement elsewhere that cults represent major deviations which yet claim to be Christian. Where in Zen Buddhism are we to find the threats of imminent Armageddon, which Mr. Martin lists among the characteristics of the cult? Virtually all the experts agree that Baha'ism, a syncretistic offspring of Shiite Islam, is a cult, and all take the International Society of Krishna Consciousness to be the model of the cult type. Yet Josh McDowell and Don Stewart define a cult as a, quote, perversion, a distortion of biblical Christianity, unquote. Why all the contradiction? Perhaps merely for tactical purposes. To be called a cult, a religion must be small, Major religions may be spared the word for reasons of decorum while being judged just as harshly. Merrill Unger, a prominent evangelical scholar, is merely more explicit than most when he pronounces not only cults, but also non-Christian world religions to be literally demonic. The authors of the Godmakers argue that Mormonism is just like Hinduism. That is, it is a system of Satan worship. The sociological considerations of cult activity, asserts Bob Larson, must mirror the standard that Christ is the source of determining error and truth. Even established world religions, which do not bear the sociological earmarks of a cult, will be included in Larson's book because of their departure from Christian theology.
Fritz Ridenauer reserves the title of cult for people like Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses, but also, biblically, condemns Judaism, Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, and Roman Catholicism. There is, in fact, a marked tendency to anti-Catholicism on the part of many self-proclaimed cult experts. J.K. Van Balen, for example, while declining to call Roman Catholicism an unchristian cult, declares nevertheless that it is a corrupt and exceedingly dangerous political machine, and it is a religious body full of doctrinal error and superstition. Attempting to refute Mormon belief in an ancient apostasy, the Utah Evangel declares that, quote, any objective study of Catholicism will reveal a small but courageous group of Christians who never bowed to Rome. Though perhaps 50 million of these died martyrs' deaths, they never ceased to exist. They rejected the papacy. They rejected baptismal regeneration. They believed in salvation by grace. They relied upon the Bible as their only rule of faith and practice. They believed in the priesthood of every believer. The church did not cease to exist. The hallmarks of cultic conversion, writes Ronald Enroth, usually include the abandonment of a familiar lifestyle, severing of ties with friends and families, a radical and sometimes sudden change in personality, the relinquishing of possessions, indoctrination with a new set of values, goals, and beliefs, the assuming of a totally new identity, including for some a new name, the acquisition of a new spiritual family, unquestioned submission to leaders and group priorities, isolation from the outside world with its attendant evil, subversion of the will, thought reform, the adoption of new sociocultural and spiritual insignia, and a host of other less dramatic, though equally significant, characteristics. However, while this definition was undoubtedly framed with Hare Krishna and the Munis in mind, it is quite as evocative of Catholic monasticism and religious orders, and is no less applicable to Thomas Merton and St. Francis of Assisi than to the Buddha and Jim Jones. The arbitrary and ad hoc character of such attempts at definition is clear in an article by the German Catholic authority on Sekten, Konrad Algemissen, citing two Protestant theologians who describe a sekte as a group accepting an extra-biblical source of authority and denying the doctrine of justification by grace alone, a description paralleled in many anti-cult polemics, Algemissen is appalled and notes that by such a definition, Catholics would be categorized as a sekte. So he simply reformulates the definition to apply to Mormons and Seventh-day Adventists, but not to Catholics. Some, such as Walter Martin, define as a cult any group which differs significantly in some one or more respects as to belief or practice from those religious groups which are regarded as the normative expression of religion in our total culture. In a move that Kierkegaard might have appreciated, the average becomes the ideal. However, this definition is of little use in a pluralistic society. Is cult status dependent upon membership statistics? Are America's Jews a cult? Is Sikhism a cult here, but a legitimate religion in India's Punjab? Or is Mr. Martin's norm, Western culture, the standard for all the planet? What of the growing Muslim minority in North America? A major world religion in Africa, Asia, and part of Europe, is Islam a cult here? At what numerical level will Islam, or Mormonism, cease to be a cult? The second century church father Tertullian felt that many non-Christians in his day desired no close investigation of Christianity, lest it be shown that the stories which they wish to have believed are untrue. In the same way, one suspects that some who use the term cult do so to warn people away from further investigation. How to cope with the cults, asks the cover of a book entitled Know the Marks of Cults. There are so many of them, all different. Who has time to study all their weird doctrines in order to refute them? Here is a better way. No need to get bogged down in the details of this or that cult. No need to debate fine points in the original Greek or Hebrew. No need to fight over the interpretation of obscure passages of Scripture. After all, as Ronald Enroth observes, there is some diversity, but, quote, In a real sense, the familiar expression, once you've seen one, you've seen them all, is applicable to current cult groups, end quote. This of a category which includes Spencer W. Kimball, the Maharishi, Seventh-day Adventists, Jonestowns, and the Rajneesh Commune in Oregon. Strange it may seem, asserts Dave Hunt with astonishing understatement, most cults are basically the same. Even apparent differences are generally only skin deep. Bob Larson knows something called cultic philosophy, although he acknowledges some variations. Walter Martin can speak of cultic vocabulary, and the title of his most ambitious book, The Kingdom of the Cults, suggests a monolithic enemy. The emotional impact and consequences of the term are implied in a story related approvingly by Ronald Inroth. In a Midwestern suburb, a religious organization called Ekankar had scheduled an informational meeting for the public in the community room of a local bank. Following the publication of a story in a major local newspaper describing Ekankar as a religious cult, the bank changed its mind and withdrew its approval of the use of the room by the group. "We weren't aware they were considered a cult," explained the bank's branch manager. The mere mention of the word cult by the local newspaper, with no consideration of the actual teachings of the group, was enough to persuade the bank manager to rescind permission to use the bank's facilities. Similarly, Moshe Rosen, the national coordinator of Jews for Jesus, laments that since his group has begun to be referred to as a cult, many pulpits that had previously been available have been closed. "Any cult," proclaims Bob Larson, "which places itself in opposition to historic Christianity should not be allowed to hide behind a cloak of religious goodwill or misleading terminology." But if polemics about cults inhibit an understanding of groups so designated and close doors to them, such words occasionally turn against their own masters. According to Newsweek, a new organization called Fundamentalists Anonymous now exists to aid those, quote, "struggling to shake fundamentalism's cult-like grip," end quote. Evangelical Christians, who often describe the aggressive proselyting methods of certain cults as brainwashing, have had the same charge leveled against them. Flo Conway and Jim Siegelman, in Snapping, America's Epidemic of Sudden Personality Change, compare evangelical conversion to joining the Moonies. Likewise, while some Christians have lauded deprogramming as a necessary and acceptable response to the indoctrination techniques of cults, Jewish parents and community leaders have used and defended similar methods, which they call counseling, for Jewish young people who have converted to Christianity, frequently of an evangelical type. In the recent and celebrated Catherine Kroll Webb rape case, prosecutors were wary of Mrs. Webb's withdrawal of her accusation against Gary Dotson, a withdrawal occasioned, she testified, by guilty conscience upon her being born again. Sources close to the investigation, the Chicago Tribune reported, say authorities remain unconvinced because the woman is associated with a religious cult and living in an emotionally charged atmosphere. Mrs. Webb is a Baptist. J.K. Van Balen long bewailed society's tolerance for anti-Christian cults such as Mormonism and Christian Science. More recently, certain anti-Mormons have sought to enlist the authoritarian regimes of Chile and Kenya against the church. But the hue and cry about cults, brainwashing, and deprogramming have brought in their wake a potential threat to the freedom of all. Religious movements, and perhaps ultimately religion itself, remarks sociologist Thomas Robbins, are increasingly being viewed as social problems. Laws have been proposed in Germany, Great Britain, Canada, and several of the United States, which, though ostensibly designed to protect against methods of brainwashing used by the Moonies, are in fact so ambiguous that they could be construed to prohibit any sort of proselyting which might lead to a change in lifestyle. Predicts Professor Robbins, as the hostility to the abuses, he puts them in quotes, the abuses of cults mounts, the general privileges and tax exemptions of churches per se will likely come under the gun. But even now, the result of the campaign against alleged cult excesses, led to a large extent by devout Christians, has been, as the evangelical scholar Irving Hexham points out, that secularists are able to urge the acceptance of laws which replace religious freedom by a grudgingly granted religious toleration. Given the hazards of the term cult, we suggest that its pejorative use be abandoned. Even in social scientific use, notes A.W. Eyster, the word remains vague and unsatisfactory. Numerous variations and extensions of these concepts exist in the literature, he writes, many of them devised without solid empirical grounding, sometimes merely rehearsing armchair definitions made decades ago, and seldom tested against actual cases, or even rigorously examined for their logical or sociological consistency. What then of those whose aim is less to understand than to condemn, whose goal is more to obscure than to illumine? Those polemicists who use the term cult seem, and like to seem, to be conveying by its use hard objective information about the groups they so designate. Perhaps the best method of determining that Mormonism is a cult, asserts the Utah Evangel, would be to consult recognized authorities in the field. We did not let the tobacco industry determine the danger in its use. We called in experts. Mormonism is incapable of assessing whether or not it is a cult. Almost all the experts say it is. Yet it is not at all clear that the information conveyed by use of the term goes beyond telling us that the group in question is one of which these alleged experts disapprove. What else can yoga, Unitarians, the Asalan Institute, and the martial arts, all incredibly listed in Larson's Book of Cults, possibly have in common? If any other criterion is offered, if it seems to be that the group under discussion must be small, weak, or passive enough that insults are without risk. Apart from theological considerations, writes Bob Larson, what classifies a certain group as a cult? Designation obviously requires a subjective value judgment. Significantly, our polemical cult experts, with no known exceptions, none known to me, avoid publishing on the subject for a scholarly audience, before which they might be held to rigorous account. It is possible, as Paul Hedengren observes, to use language in such a way as to appear superficially to be making assertions, when in fact the language use is logically equivalent to growling. Instead of the abused and abusive term cult, we propose more neutral terminology such as religious movement, religious group, or church. Perhaps the best approach would be to apply to each group the name which its adherents use in referring to themselves. This action alone would practically eliminate the term cult from religious discourse. Further, no false uniformity would be imposed upon widely differing faiths. As Tertullian insisted, truth requests only that she not be condemned without a hearing. Latter-day Saints, and doubtless others currently stigmatized as cultists, ask little more than that their doctrines and teachings be granted a fair hearing, with the way cleared of impediments, lexical or otherwise.
Of the numerous excellent points made by Professors Ricks and Peterson, I should like to center my comments on three. First, the contemporary usage of the word cult. Second, proposals to legislate or regulate activities related to so-called brainwashing or proselytizing. And third, their suggestion that we abandon the term cult and use more neutral terminology. In one sense, no one should be disturbed by the application of the word cult. It's derived from the Latin cultus and means to cultivate or to worship. Webster offers several explanatory definitions, one of which reads, "The system of outward forms and ceremonies used in worship, religious rites and formalities." Under this definition, virtually every religion known to history is properly called a cult. However, another of Webster's descriptive phrases brings us nearer to the way people use the word today. Quote, "Devoted attachment to or extravagant admiration for a person, principle, etc., especially when regarded as a fad, as, for example, the cult of nudism." He selected the example, I did not. It's my observation that the term has gained greater currency since the tragedy of Jonestown, so that now there is an almost inescapable linkage between the word cult and that which is bizarre or degrading. Writing prior to Jonestown, Stoner and Park commented, "Many do not deserve the denigration that has been leveled at them by critics who lump all new religious groups together in one derogatory category, cults. Time may prove that some of the movements are in fact legitimate endeavors at new forms of religious expression." A cult is a religious group whose faith, custom, and practice appears strange to an outside observer. It is correct, as Ricks and Peterson have told us, that members of religious groups seldom, if ever, refer to their own group as a cult. The term is most often applied by outsiders who, for whatever reason, are critical of another religious group. Obviously, I dislike the word cult. But neither can I deny that some religious groups are so totally outside my personal experience that I'm hard-pressed to find a satisfactory non-pejorative to describe them. So if out of necessity the word must be occasionally used, what sort of groups are we talking about? One of the calmest, most objective analyses of groups which might suitably wear the appellation cult is found in the writings of Carol Stoner and Joanne Park, whom I quoted earlier. They list 9 criteria for determining the legitimacy of a new religion and, by implication, whether or not the group is a cult. Quote, a cult has a living leader. Cult doctrine is based on his or her revelations, which either supplant or supplement traditional religious doctrine or scripture. The cult leader is the sole judge of the quality of a member's faith, and he enjoys absolute authority over the members. He often lives in kingly splendor while his subjects live in poverty. A cult promises a system in which a convert may work to save the world and humanity, but actually sponsors no community improvement programs. The daily work of nearly all cult members is demeaning and utilizes little of their potential in terms of intelligence, training, or education. Religious cults are exclusive social systems, claiming that their members will achieve salvation or happiness. Members are taught that they are superior to those outside the group. To be a member of a cult, a person must remove himself from society, cut himself off from job, education, friends, and family. Methods of ego destruction and thought control are part of a religious cult's recruiting and indoctrination practices. Cults discourage analysis by dictating the suppression of negative thoughts, therefore fostering a dependency on the cult's authority that arrests the maturation process. The cult rituals and practices are psychologically unwholesome and in some cases physically dangerous when they involve the use of drugs or perverse sexual rites. That is the end of the quotation from Stoner and Parks. Obviously, one reason this topic is on today's agenda is that some of the more vocal anti-Mormons about have gone on radio and television talk shows, given newspaper interviews, and written books which seek to pillory the LDS Church with the disparaging term cult. In a book which Newsweek magazine recently listed as one of the top 10 bestsellers among religious books during the past 20 years, Walter Martin lists Mormonism as a cult, along with, among others, the Jehovah's Witnesses, Christian Science, and the Unity School of Christianity. Martin's own definition of a cult is quite simple. Quote, a cult might also be defined as a group of people gathered about a specific person or person's interpretation of the Bible. End of quote. This is such a limited definition that Walter Martin need only look into a mirror to discover the latest cult. If, however, we consider the far more studious and comprehensive set of criteria offered by Stoner and Park, no serious person could label the Mormons a cult. And we should all be much slower in applying that opprobrium to other groups until we understand them more thoroughly and have had sufficient time to witness what fruit they bear. For myself, I dislike the term cult so much that I will not consciously use it. There are religious groups different from my own. There are religious groups whose customs seem peculiar to me. There are religious groups which make demands I am unwilling to accept. There are religious groups whose worship practices would prove completely unsatisfying to me. There are religious groups which appear to me as an insult to ordinary intelligence. But having said this, I have also discovered that some of the groups which I would find impossible to belong to and which look strange to me nevertheless produce some people of outstanding quality. I recognize in their membership people of character and integrity, people of industry and endeavor, responsible citizens, people who create, nurture, and sustain fine families, those who are faithful to God as they perceive Him. I cannot call such people cultists. I cannot libel their religious communities as cults. I'm deeply concerned by any movement which seeks to bring the force of government into play regulating religious customs and practices. I say this fully aware that the Reynolds decision of the Supreme Court declared in 1875, laws are made for the government of actions, and while they cannot interfere with mere religious beliefs and opinions, they may with practice. The practical effect of this ruling was to end the practice of plural marriage, as was a widespread custom among Mormons in the middle years of the 19th century. Most of us would probably agree that government should act in those instances where a practice of religion involves harm to persons or the illegal appropriation of property. But such cases are few, and no one should rush to our legislatures with proposals to regulate religious behavior. I'm really far less concerned about the danger of states or the federal government enacting regulations related to proselytizing or alleged brainwashing than I am about the way in which various religious groups in America today interrelate voluntarily. Perhaps the most insightful study ever made of the attitudes which religious groups hold about other groups and which they convey to their constituencies was the late Dr. Bernhard Olson's great 1963 book, Faith and Prejudice. Olson observed, quote, "Though the political structure of America is designed to give freedom to its members, the fact remains that the defamation of certain groups and the threat to their rights receive tacit or active support from various sectors of society, including some that claim they draw their sanction from Christian ideology." Close of the quote. Though Olson wrote particularly about the roots of anti-Semitism, his comment remains valid today. For our contemporary religious scene is filled with those who defame any who do not accept their own authoritarian tenets. Anti-Mormons certainly fit into this category. The classical definition of prejudice is this: to judge or condemn before proper inquiry. Ricks and Peterson's position paper is entirely correct in its assertion that calling another religious group a cult is meant to close minds to further thought or inquiry. It is an encouragement to some individuals to prejudge the target group. It is not unfair that we conclude that to label any group a cult is to exhibit a form of prejudice no different in substance than statements which allege, quote, all blacks are, and you fill in the stereotype, or all Jews are, or all Mormons are, and whatever you want to conclude in that sentence. In 1974, the United States Supreme Court declared, quote, "Under the First Amendment, there is no such thing as a false idea. However pernicious an opinion may seem, we depend not on the conscience of judges and juries, but on the competition of other ideas." Obviously, those who sued the NCCJ, the ADL, and the LDS Church, and several of us as individuals seeking $25 million in compensation, do not believe that. Stoner and Parks also make an affirmation of their own. Religious freedom demands that any religion, no matter how bizarre its theology, be allowed to flourish. And in Scripture, the wise Rabbi Gamaliel advised critics of the preaching of Peter and the apostles, quote, "So in the present case, I tell you, keep away from these men and let them alone. For if this plan or this understanding is of men, it will fail. But if it is of God, you will not be able to overthrow them. You might even be found opposing God." Close quote. In conclusion, it's needless to say that I agree with Ricks and Peterson. We should abandon use of the word cult, just as we have abandoned forms of religious and racial prejudice, stereotypes, and so-called trigger words. There are several questions which I should like to propose to each of you. First, what is the proper way for one religious group to relate to another in our pluralistic society? Second, do we really want to live in communities where every religious group asserts its own truths as absolute while aggressively, publicly attacking other faiths? Third, is it really necessary to denigrate the beliefs, history, or traditions of another religion in order to advance our own? Fourth, would our society be a better place if all religious groups taught, advocated, and practiced respect toward all others? Robert A. Ashworth has wisely written, "When we are rightly informed as to the beliefs and practices of our neighbors, we may still disagree with them profoundly, but we are not as likely to dislike, distrust, or malign them." And I might add, nor to call them cults. Thank you.
We'd like to thank these three gentlemen for their participation today, and at this time give you the opportunity of asking them some questions. We'd ask that you would speak up and direct your questions to one of the gentlemen in particular. Go ahead.
Steve Ricks, could you use that reference again to that book that talks about the primitive church itself displaying cultic characteristics?
Yeah. It is not a book. It is an article that appeared in the In Encounter, a religious journal which is published in Indianapolis, Indiana. It was published in 1983, and it's volume 44. Okay.
I have two questions. First of all, I think that most everyone here has the impression that the word cult is something strong and warm. And of course, we all know that the victim is a context that Martin Peterson used that word, and Luther McConnell used that word, all three of them referring to those who adhered to the Mormons 100 years ago. Also, it seems to me that the word cult, when one looks at the dictionary, has a more honorific interpretation than what has been alluded to here. The word culture, in fact, comes from the word cult. And if you would comment on those two points of history, I should appreciate that.
With regard to the first statement that you made, we are aware of the fact that certain of the general authorities of the LDS Church have used the term cult or cultist with reference to other groups. We do not either defend or attack their use of it. I think we could merely describe it as their way of expressing disapproval of those groups, and perhaps somewhat the same way that the term is used to express disapproval by others of Mormons. With respect to the second, I felt that at the beginning of our discussion, also in Mr. Eagle's discussion, that the original sense of the word, which is in fact from a Latin root, colere, which means two things, very interestingly, either to till the soil or to worship, a combination of meanings that is found in a variety of languages, both Indo-European as well as Semitic, and that the term both cult as well as culture are derived from this root. That is true, but we are not. We did not wish to entertain that to the extent that we did the other use, this pejorative use of cult, with specific reference to Mormonism. As Mr. Eagle has pointed out, in fact, all groups that use the term cult, all groups that are of a religious sort and have a worship form should feel flattered to have cult used with reference to them, but it is quite clear that at least within the past few years that another term has emerged which has a pejorative connotation, and it is that term, that is that sense, that connotation, which we wish to deal with and did deal with in the body of our presentation.
Can I just add something to that? I don't like the term cult at all, but I don't quarrel with it so much when it's used to say I don't like this group, as I think Brother Benson, Brother McConkie, Brother Pearson were using it to mean. What I object to is the pseudoscientific, sort of after-the-fact elaboration of criteria to justify one's application of this type of groups, where you try to pretend that you're passing on objective information about the group by calling it a cult, which in fact I think nobody can. The definitions are so incoherent, in many cases, and incoherently applied by the people who devise them. If someone were to say, I believe that person X is a jerk, that's one thing. I know that means that he doesn't like person X. If he begins telling me that he believes that person X is a jerk because person X fulfills all of the 9 conditions of jerkhood, then I begin to think that he's playing word games, to put it mildly. That I object to, the idea that there's some scientific reality, some objective reality being conveyed here. Most of these people aren't even interested in objective reality or in conveying information.
We've got to look at our own house, though.
Very much, yeah. But I say, I don't think if you were to catch one of these brethren, there's only one of them to be caught right now, that he would be willing or inclined to give you a list of the 25 scientific agreed-upon criteria of a cult.
Of course, McConkie has done that.
Well,
I just add briefly that I think everybody, including church leaders, have to be conscious of the fact that as words progress in usage through different periods of time, they take on meanings which render them unacceptable to use. We have seen the word Negro, for example, which at one time was a perfectly honorable word to use and was preferred over the word color, pass from currency so that you do not use it anymore. You must use the term black to be properly referring to that racial group. And each time a word changes its meaning, those of us who use them in public forms of address must be aware of the broad spread currency of that usage and adapt ourselves to them. So even church authorities sometimes have to update their vocabulary.
I disagree with the use of the pejorative term, of course. I feel a little bit bad that Gerald and Sandra Tanner are 2 rooms over and unable to participate in this discussion, however. Maybe in light of Sandra Atkin, maybe I can present a scenario of perhaps an LDS ward that may have a particularly charismatic or authoritative leader that kind of goes off in some direction. I think that we would feel, the church would feel, a need to differentiate themselves from this other group. And although, as I'll repeat, I disagree with the pejorative term, I can sympathize and understand and agree with the position of the evangelical Christians who see what I call, or what maybe more accurate term, pseudo-Christian groups. In other words, groups that use the same sorts of terms as the evangelicals do, but those terms have much different meanings. And I can see that there is an importance of warning people against these kinds of groups and making them aware of just what how these groups differentiate. And perhaps we ought to make a distinction on that issue.
I would just like to ask, what is a pseudo-Christian, and how do you establish what a pseudo-Christian is?
Okay. Well, I can tell you how they do it. I'm not necessarily taking that position myself.
there are a number of doctrines that evangelicals assume to be fundamental, and we all could probably list them. The virgin birth, the deity of Christ, the bodily resurrection, etc. And they believe these things are fundamental not simply because they like their creed, but because these ideas are fundamental to the Christian regenerative process. In other words, if Jesus Christ is simply a man, then his atonement doesn't really, it's not efficacious in my life. Now, as a term, if there's a group out there calling themselves Christian and teaching that Jesus Christ is just a man, and people are flocking to that group and not seeing those distinctions, then I think it's important to point those out.
It's remarkable, though, that I have never seen in any of these writings anything about Unitarians who do precisely that sort of thing.
Walter Martin has written a book called The Cult of Liberalism.
All right. I would say that 9 out of 10 do not, and I think that that is something to be noted.
And it should be mentioned, too, that by Walter Martin's own definition of cults, Unitarians don't fit. On the other hand, Walter Martin gives at least, as far as I'm aware, at least 4 definitions of cults, some of which are mutually contradictory. And then when he applies his own definitions, he applies the term cult to groups that escape his own definitions. The man is just a teeming mass of contradictions.
I agree.
Yes, Mr. Anello, as a matter of fact, aren't there 2 elements here that we haven't directly dealt with? And one is that one doesn't bother to call names like cults unless one feels somewhat threatened. And that some of the calling of the Mormons as cultists is a happening at the time, and perhaps in response to the somewhat aggressive missionary tactics as perceived by those outside. And one doesn't bother to denigrate a group unless one feels somewhat threatened by them. And this is then also an element of sort of verbal immaturity. That
it's
just simply a version of name-calling.
Yeah, I think there's that. Although I'm not sure that it's necessarily a function of weakness or fear, because in a lot of ways, Martin Marty talked about the Baptistification of America, you know, that in a lot of ways the evangelical new right is on the ascendant, and it's at a moment when, in fact, they're more powerful than they've been in a long, long time. I mean, fundamentalist Christianity was sort of off in the fever swamps for a long time as far as the rest of the country was concerned after things like the Scopes trial and so on. Now they're back. I mean, there are big debates about scientific creationism and so on. There's a new sense of power and being on the rise in those circles. And so it seems to me that to say they're calling us a cult because they're afraid of us may not be, I mean, that may be a function of it. Mormonism is also doing extremely well in the last few decades, but we're part of a general resurgence of I know the fundamentalists wouldn't like this, but a resurgence of conservative churches, that is, churches that make demands and so on their membership. So it's not as if we're suddenly on the ascendant and they're suddenly weak, it seems to me.
I stated that badly. What I should have said is that we are definitely in competition.
Yes.
And where in the past, if you tell these written off, but with the growth, we have become an item to be reckoned with, and can't really be ignored.
Well, I think that we would wish to point out that we were not merely talking about us as to whom this is applied. We feel just as strongly about the term being used with reference to Jehovah's Witnesses or even Ekon Kar or Hare Krishna or whatever group. In fact, there is a whole galaxy of groups to whom this particular word is applied. And perhaps now the competition, because there are a great variety of groups, there is a certain amount of competition felt. And I think that it needs to be said that some of these people probably feel very keenly and very sincerely a sort of a repugnance about the practices of these individuals. Well, I would say for one thing that from my own reading of 19th century sources, the gloves were on a lot less when it came to religious polemics. And so what Joseph Smith may have said in the first half of the 19th century may have been quite rough. I don't think he would say it today. You know, you read anti-Catholic polemics and so on. The only people I know who are doing that are the Tony and Susan Alamo Foundation now in Arkansas. In fact, we've learned that it's easier to get along with people, and it's much more useful to speak civilly to one another.
I really do think that the Christians being called an abomination is what this is all about.
Oh, no, they never mention that. Never, never. Honestly, if you survey the material, that never comes up. Never that. Never.
It's not, you called us that first, so now we're going to call you that. It's simply, it's much more recent. They're not that, most of them do not seem to be sufficiently aware of our past that is an issue that comes up, or at least that one that they raise.
But, you know, if you want to go back into the 19th century, it's certainly not Joseph Smith's peculiar language. It's typical of early 19th century religious polemic.
Much of what was written in the early part of the 19th century, especially even during the latter part of the 19th century, would be termed libelous or slanderous in the 20th century. There's simply no question about it, not merely actually in the realm of religion, religious discourse, but also of political discourse. Things were said about President Lincoln that make anything. The meanest things have been said about Ronald Reagan in the press pale. And so it was. It was just much more rough and tumble in those days. And I think that the term abomination needs to be appreciated in that context. If taken out of context, its meaning is going to be, I think, distorted.
Unfortunately, we're out of time. Okay? Thank you for your participation today.